Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. For sports fans, few things are more fun than arguing about, well, everything. Greatest games, greatest teams, greatest eras, greatest coaches, and most of all, greatest players. When the discussion turns to basketball's greatest players, few people bring more knowledge to the table than Sam Smith and Phil Jackson. At the Chicago Tribune, Smith covered the Michael Jordan-era Chicago Bulls, coached by Jackson, and the NBA for decades. Jackson, a former player with the New York Knicks championship teams of the 1970s, went on to become one of the NBA's greatest coaches in the 90s and 2000s. He led the Bulls and Los Angeles Lakers to 11 titles. Let that sink in. 11 championships, including three three-peats, two with the Bulls and one with the Lakers. Jackson became known as the Zen Master for his embrace of what at the time were unorthodox tactics to motivate his players. Here he is explaining his methods to Oprah Winfrey.
You know, as much as we pump iron and we run to build our strength up, we need to build our mental strength up. We need to build our mental strength so we can focus, get one-pointed attention, and so that we can be in concert with one another in times of need. Mm-hmm. When you come off the court, you've had a bad call, things going wrong for you, you sit on the bench, you take a breath and you reseat yourself, you reset yourself. And you do that through this mindfulness. You just come right back in and collect yourself. So we practiced mindfulness, is what you have to do.
Jackson and Smith in recent years have spent time together discussing NBA players in history. Talks captured in their new book, Masters of the Game. Sam Smith is here today to share his thoughts on their book and maybe to confirm our bias that North Carolina is, without any debate needed, the ultimate basketball state. Sam, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you. Glad to talk to you.
So this book explores NBA history through the back and forth discussions between yourself and Phil Jackson about 75 different players spanning the league's history. Now, you've known Phil for many years. You covered him when he was a coach. What was it like to work with him in this way?
That was kind of the fun, the enjoyable part for me, and kind of sort of how it all got started. Kind of the genesis of it was, I kept in touch with Phil. I don't get invited to Oprah much, but he does. And so, a lot of ways, obviously, Phil is kind of a unique guy, but I also know him. Got to know him personally. We're not close friends, but, work friends. And because he's, kind of an interesting person. And, there's frankly not the whole lot in the country. When he finished coaching and I covered him with the Bulls and he moved on to the Lakers and I was covering the NBA, I would cover more Lakers. I would come up with excuses and reasons to get out to L.A. And Chicago was always interested in Phil. And, of course, they had Kobe and everything. So then when he finally retired, from the NBA after this little brief span with the Knicks, I kind of kept in touch. I'm still writing for the Bulls website, bulls.com. And so I would travel with trips occasionally with the team, L.A., particularly since I live in Chicago. winter was always good. And so I'd have lunch with Phil, kind of kept in touch, just kind of a unique person. And then I write books kind of on NBA history, sort of, and I'm interested generally in history, all sorts, but, and much of it gets forgotten about, overlooked, in some cases in our country now, purposely excised. But I've tried to always keep the memories and the lessons and the legacies of these players alive. And more so in recent years, there's been this kind of diminishment of their accomplishments and who they are. You hear a lot of, well, they couldn't play in this era, the athleticism, the training, they weren't in, and of course they could. Wilt Chamberlain was literally an Olympic athlete in track. It's hard to tell me that, you know, a 275-pound man who could sprint faster than any, you know, sprint as fast as Olympians couldn't play today. But in any case, so I've written some, wrote some books previously. I wrote a book with Oscar Robertson about the suit that led to the merger in 1976 and free agency. And I kind of realized as time went on and I'd spent time with these players, as it happens, they were dying and their stories were sort of disappearing, obviously. So I started to kind of collect these stories. And around the time of the pandemic, I was having a lunch with Phil and it's kind of, hey, what are you doing lately? What are you doing? And so I sort of, I never thought to recruit him to work with me and basically knew he was done working. And it was just friends talking. And I was telling him about this and the NBA top 75 players of all time had come out. The NBA puts out these lists after 50 years, top 50, 75 years, top 70. And I said, you know, in growing up in New York City, I've seen literally every one of these guys play in person, other than George Mikan, because they'd be at the Madison Square Garden as a kid in high school. And the Knicks, the NBA wasn't popular in that area. And so the Knicks always had doubleheaders on Tuesdays. And so we could go, we had a special card from our high school, and I could get into the Garden for 75 cents. And they were four teams, and it was eight teams in the league. So literally half the league was in the building, you know, every Tuesday night. And so I saw Wilt and Russell and Oscar, and we're talking about this. And I said, well, you know, you literally played against them or coached virtually everyone too, other than Mikan, because he played against Wilt and that whole era. And I just sort of off the top of my head, I said, well, you know, I think I'm going to collect these stories, maybe write a book. Would you be interested in doing it with me? And he goes, well, yeah, I would. And I was kind of a little taken aback, but I thought, whoa, I mean, I got something here. And I said, well, even if it's not a book, it kind of be cool to hang out with Phil. What happened is I ended up setting, he spends the summers in his, he has a place in Montana on Flathead Lake where his grandkids come up, and he kind of does Camp Phil all summer. But when the kids leave him at Labor Day to go back to school, he doesn't head back to LA for the winter until the end of October. So he's got that period at the end of September. So I went up to Montana just kind of to hang out with him up there, have, you know, hang out, have lunches, dinners. And then just kind of turned on the tape recorder and said, you know, let's talk about each of these guys.
And he was more than willing.
Yeah, he was great. And actually at one point toward the end, when the book was writing the book, actually, I said, you know, Phil, how come you did this? I'm kind of surprised, actually. You know, I'm glad we have this relationship and friendly, but I'm surprised you wanted to. And he said, frankly, I miss, you know, being involved in the NBA. I don't watch it that much anymore. I don't like all the three-point shooting. You know, I don't enjoy it as much. But, you know, I've really felt kind of a loss of connection. So he felt this is a way to sort of get back and keep up and, you know, sort of talk about. And he there's just some, you know, you don't think about, I don't know if a lot of people know about the process of writing a book, but you write a book and like a year and a half later, it comes out like now. And so, you know, I did most of the writing on the book. You know, I set it up on Conversationally, of us talking, sort of almost like a play,
Yeah, it makes it a fast read, the dialogue, the back and forth as the two of you are having observations about these players.
Right, and I think that's the kind of the appeal and the charm of it, sort of like a Waiting for Godot, you know, two guys sitting around talking, waiting for something, but just in, you know, in little short digestible segments, like just sitting in a movie, popping some popcorn and, you know, then getting on to the next one or just picking the one you sort of want to read. But, the writing process was finished like a year and a half ago. And so, you know, as I've come up with some of these interviews, I said, well, let me take a look at this book because I'm still.
What did we talk about?
I'm still writing every day, you know, on the Bulls website. I follow the team. I don't travel as much as I used to, but you still go to the games and write game stories and columns and things. And so I've done a lot of writing since then. And so I'd take a peek back at the book and I keep going, whoa, that's interesting. You know, it just seems like there's so many little nuggets and gems about these players and the history and the interaction that he and I have had with them. Because literally we know all of them. And kind of that's the idea. It's not like a list of another, you know, who's the top 50, you know, who's the best, you know, who's the best. I get people like to debate, you know, Michael, LeBron, all that, who's the best point guard. But I think this is unique in how is that we don't rank them and we just kind of talk about them as people who know them, who spend time with them and, you know, could tell some of their stories.
So since we're taking a North Carolina perspective here, in the case of Michael Jordan, it doesn't matter because everything seems to start and end with Michael Jordan. But let's start with, as I said, you covered him. You wrote the Jordan Rules back in the early 90s when they won their first title. I want to begin with a moment. Game 5 of the 1997 NBA Finals. This is NBC's Ahmad Rashad setting the scene.
All right, thanks, Marv. At 3:30 this morning, Michael Jordan woke up with flu-like symptoms. He had a stomach ache and a headache, and he couldn't go back to sleep. He threw up all night, and as reported earlier, he missed a shoot-around, but he was in bed all day and continued to throw up. As a matter of fact, he got in here early. When I went to talk to him back in the back room, he was in a dark room trying to get some rest, but still throwing up. And Marv, I talked to him. I said, how do you feel? He said, I really feel horrible. But his history in games where he's either been hurt or sick has been bad news for the opponent. And as you can see, he's ready to go tonight. Marv?
So they're talking, obviously, you were there about Michael Jordan being sick. He ended up scoring 38 points, as you well know, in what became known as the flu game. But since then has become known for maybe being the food poisoning game. So set us straight. What happened that night?
Well, it wasn't poison pizza, as great a story that was. It's like, you know, kind of in The Last Dance, you know, I'd end up doing some interviews. You know, I was sort of ambivalent about whether they'd ask me. You know, I had a imperfect relationship with Michael. I had a great relationship when I was covering him in the late 80s. And then I wrote some books, which he wasn't thrilled about everything. You know, although it's been fine when I've run into him. When he owned, you know, the Charlotte team, I'd run into him there a couple of times. And he was always, and he's always been great like that. He would, you know, give me a hard time. Hey, I see you sold that, you know, you're working for the Bulls now, kind of things. That's the way he is. You know, he's always likes to drive the needle in. And that's actually why, you know, I enjoyed spending time with him. And, you know, just sort of as an aside, after I wrote the Jordan Rules and there was a lot of controversy and, you know, he was on the defensive a little bit, to his credit, he never, unlike a lot of players, and still you see that, he never took it out on me, never was personal. I was still covering the team, you know, and around the team. He was answering my questions just like everyone else. He, you know, he was a mensch. Anyway, so when The Last Dance comes out, which I've kind of alluded to sometimes as like a TV movie, based on a true story kind of thing. So, no, it wasn't the food poisoning. What it was, I'll tell you the real story. What happened was the Bulls were in Park City staying, and they were coming back into Salt Lake in the Valley each day for practices, games, back and forth, you know, commuting, and he got altitude sickness. And so that, and you know, it's a real sickness, and he was throwing up and he was sick. There was no doubt about that. But they decided, either him or the Bulls, I don't know who, that altitude sickness didn't sound great for the world's greatest player. And so they had a mask it to be something else. So they made it the flu.
So it became the flu. Well, let's take a timeout. We'll have the ultimate teaser here. When we come back, we'll continue with Michael Jordan and the 1997 finals game when he overcomes a bout of throwing up, to say the least. This is Charlotte Talks. Stay with us for more.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest is Sam Smith, who covered the Chicago Bulls in the NBA for the Chicago Tribune for many years, still covers the Bulls, and who became a best-selling author with a chronicle of the Bulls' first championship called The Jordan Rules. His new book, written with Phil Jackson, is Masters of the Game. And Sam, we took that time out, and you were talking about how altitude sickness was not a sufficient description for Michael Jordan. So they went with the flu. Either way, he was very ill, and he still performed magnificently. Any surprise to you watching that unfold?
No question at all. And actually, and that is Jordan in the sense that, and, you know, because you're, if you look at it objectively, you say, well, how could he be the best? You know, if you really don't know basketball, you say, well, how could he be the best ever? He's not the best shooter. He's not even close. He wasn't a great shooter. He's certainly not the greatest rebounder, shot blocker, Will Chamberlain, Bill Russell, you know, Hakeem, and, you know, Shaq any days. He's not the greatest passer. He's, you know, not Jason Kidd or, you know, John Stockton and even Isaiah Thomas. So how is it the guy that is not the best at anything could be considered the best at everything? And part of it is that this incredible, almost a sickness of a competitiveness and challenge. And so, you know, we've always heard all the legendary stories of, you know, a player questioning Jordan and he's, okay, I'll show you, and scores the next 20 points or something. And it's almost like, you know, sort of, God, illness, you're going to try to stop me? You're going to make me sick? Well, I'll show you. And so, yeah, he played through. One of the things I most appreciated about Michael as a player, and it resonates so much now when players don't play and take so much time off and won't play through, he never didn't play. When he came back to basketball after, you know, almost 2 years out playing baseball, which is a completely different body setup, he didn't miss a game, not one single game for 3.5 years.
Load management was not in his vocabulary.
Yeah. And, oh, I remember these episodes. There were other players on the Bulls who were in the trainer's room, and he would go in there and say, everybody, and this was practice. When I'm talking about games, you know, like Allen Iverson, games, you know, he'd come in at practice. He said, no, nobody's in the training room today. If this is all you're doing is getting treatment, you're practicing. And he would drive those guys all the time. I mean, you had to show up. And when the best guy showed up and worked, you know, and everybody talks, it's sort of laughable today. You talk to basketball athletes, especially basketball players, oh my God, I work so hard. I work so hard. You know, I'm sure you and I work much harder than they do. They work 3 hours a day. I mean, let's come on. But anyway, Michael it was this incredible, serious competitor. And when the best guy competes like that, you just can't. And then that's what drove those Bulls teams, because you had the best guy by far competing the hardest and relentlessly. And I remember there was a 5-year stretch. He missed one game. He supposedly was sick. He wasn't sick, but the team was doing badly. And he kind of said, okay, you know, and they were saying, well, you shoot too much. Actually, it was a big narrative for a long time in Chicago. You can never win. The Bulls will never win because Jordan's selfish. He shoots so much. He leads the league in scoring. And came in and he said, all right, you know, okay. So you want to try it without me? And he did take a game off. We went to Boston. It was like 88, 89 season. I don't remember exactly which year. And that, because it was the only game he missed in 5 years. And I called him during the game. From the game, it was like the third quarter and the Bulls were down 35. And he said, I'll be there tomorrow and this is over. And he went on. He had triple doubles in 9 of the next 10 games.
Speaking of showing up, a year after the flu game or altitude sickness game, Michael led the Bulls to their 6th and final championship. This is before his 2nd retirement. Here's Bob Costas describing the end of Game 6 of the finals.
Here comes Chicago. 17 seconds. 17 seconds from Game 7 or from championship number 6. Jordan open. Chicago with the lead. Timeout, Utah. 5.2 seconds left. Michael Jordan running on fumes with 45 points.
Sam, at this point, as I mentioned, the Bulls have won 5 championships. They're about to win their 6th. After seeing him that many years and in that many situations, what are you thinking going into that 1998 finals? In other words, do you look at this as it's inevitable that they win again?
Yes, by that point, the league was so intimidated by Jordan. I mean, it literally was intimidating. It was interesting to watch before the games, you know, when he would come out, you know, to do the layup line, a little practice before the game. Literally every player on the other team would stop what they were doing and just stare, just to see him. I mean, by that point in his accomplishments, and always one of the reasons I'll bring when they have the debate and I have to get into it about Jordan, LeBron, who's the greatest ever. It's clearly Jordan. And not just, you can argue the basketball, but you can't argue the social impact. Nobody changed the world from a sports perspective more than Michael Jordan did. You know, and yes, Muhammad Ali had tremendous influence, but wasn't that well liked. You know, same with Tiger Woods. Tremendous influence, but during his era, wasn't well liked. Not only was Jordan was a beloved figure, but the social change, the sneakers, the fashion, people's fashion is built around how this guy was dressing. You know, men are comfortable. They look forward to being bald now. It's okay, because Michael Jordan made baldness cool. And wearing earrings, jewelry, that started all this stuff with this guy. And so he has such a social impact that it transcends everything. And if you say, okay, if you want to call it a tie in basketball, I wouldn't call it a tie. And actually, one thing Phil points out in the book, and that was the other thing, we didn't want to get into ranking, especially Phil. He was uncomfortable, no ranking.
You just have the 75 players. They're not ranked.
Right. And even when he did the table of contents, he made it clear to the publisher, and they just put it in, like, I think, historical order. You know, starting with Mike and Cousy, whatever. I can't remember. But he said, you know, we're not ranking him. When I got him at one point, finally, to say, all right, Michael, LeBron, he said, well, let me put it this way. Everything Michael started, meaning every finals he finished, and to me, that's what matters. He said, LeBron didn't finish his. He finished some of them, but he didn't finish that many of them. Michael finished every one. When Michael started something, he finished. And so that's your question, 97, 98. Now, it was kind of the last dance, you know, Phil's famous thing and the, you know, the TV, you know, documentary they made. But, you know, that made it clear all season that, you know, we're leaving, you know. And you know, because Rodman had his meltdown that year, left for Vegas, you know, jumped the team. You know, and that was also to Phil's credit that he could weave these things into a team instead of making an issue, you know, because Rodman basically went AWOL. You know, how many teams would put up with that? You know, but that was part of it. Anyway, you mentioned that you played that Costas thing. And by the way, Bob did a thing with the Bulls. I just saw him a couple of days ago. He was in Chicago to host a kind of Bulls Hall of Fame thing they do. But if fans look back, that's one of that sequence at the end of the game defined Jordan's greatness in so many ways. Not only is it the end of his career and the end of what he knows is going to be the end with the Bulls, but he makes the greatest offense and defensive sequence. Because on one end, the Bulls had to get the ball back without Utah scoring. Utah scores there, the game's all over. So he realizes the play, you know, so he's two plays ahead. He knows they're going to Karl Malone, you know, on that baseline play. And so he stations himself along the opposite end of the baseline where he could get across and come up from behind Malone and strip the ball. So he does that, makes a defensive play, handles the ball, you know, they don't call timeout. So Utah can't set up their defense, gets up and then gets in position. He didn't push off. It's a natural arm movement. He had looked in tremendously long arms and big hands. So that's just that the other guy kind of flopped and gets in position and he makes the clutch play. That there's these incredible photos of him from behind, if you see. And it quiets and you see an entire arena over his shoulder behind him, just like with their mouths open, because the game's and just wins the game like that. And so it kind of in one sequence kind of defined who Michael Jordan was. Makes the clutch defensive play and the clutch offensive play, which nobody, Wilt could do it on offense. Bill Russell could do it on defense. LeBron didn't do it on offense. Nobody did to Jordan's extent. And that's why he is who he is.
And that's why we're spending a lot of time on Michael Jordan. But I want to get to some other players since we're talking about the 75 greatest, and a number of them have North Carolina ties. And you even get into some executives and coaches that you mention offhand. A couple who are of interest in this part of the country, Larry Brown and Carl Shear, who spent a lot of time in the Carolinas and here in Charlotte. Yeah. Carl Shear invented the slam dunk contest, I'm sure, as you know. But I was wondering if you would share with the audience the story about George McGinnis, who was a star player in the 70s. And at the time, yeah. Carl Shear is the general manager. Larry Brown is the coach. And Larry Brown wants George McGinnis. And what happens next?
Yeah, one of my favorite stories. And Larry's, I knew Larry well, grew up in, you know, New York area, followed his career. And, you know, you had to be on the move to follow Larry's career because it was moving around a lot. But I was really devoted to North Carolina and Dean Smith and, you know, was around Michael as well, too. And Larry's, you know, peripatetic as history is, you know, he's not satisfied. When he was coach of the Pacers, Donnie Walsh, the GM, told me Larry literally came in every day to beg him to trade Reggie Miller. Got to get him out of here. He can't create his own shots, you know. And
Hall of Famer Reggie Miller, yes.
Yeah, top 75. You know, Donnie Walsh would shake his head. They were close friends, grew up, you know, knew each other from school, college, growing up. Donnie would shake his head, sure, Larry, okay. And, you know, of course, not do anything about it. So anyway, now, when this was back when Larry was coaching Denver. And George McGinnis was, you know, he was in the ABA, was a great, he was basically LeBron of his time. His career faded out more quickly, but, you know, big 260-pound player. You know, LeBron's size is ridiculous, but a 6'8", 260, handle the ball, go full court, rare physical, you know, much like LeBron. And so Larry's coaching the Nuggets. I got to have, it goes, he's going into Carl Shear like every day, same like with Donnie and Reggie Miller. I got to have George McGinnis. We got to have George McGinnis. So finally, after like 3 months of badgering Carl, he makes this trade. He pulls off. But George McGinnis was typically, historically, not a committed player. That's why his career ended quickly. Didn't take practice seriously. And so he comes in the first practice. I think he maybe been smoking a cigarette and kind of sat down after like 3 minutes. Larry goes in to call Shear and says, "You got to trade George McGinnis. I can't coach George McGinnis. He can't play." Carl went on a scouting trip for the next 2 months.
So thank you for doing what I asked you to do. Now get rid of him.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is certainly not uncommon among NBA coach, but especially Larry Brown, which is why he's such a beloved figure.
I want to ask you about somebody else who the two of you mentioned in passing. He's not one of the top 75 players, but for people who saw him play, they remember him vividly. And I'm talking about David Thompson, who is another North Carolina native. He played at NC State, led them to a national championship in 1974, goes into the NBA and suffers from drug addiction and flames out early. But what do you think of when you think of David Thompson in his prime?
Well, I think of Michael Jordan. You know, and Michael actually was a big admirer of David Thompson. Michael growing up, I think he patterned himself. I think he hoped to be David Thompson. I think that's who he admired as a player. And I remember, you know, seeing David many, many times in college and was just, you know, your breath was taken away watching him play. He was one of the most spectacular players I've ever seen. And like I say, I've seen them, every single one of them, basically. And I know Mikan couldn't jump, so I wasn't really worried about that. But he recovered and got himself, you know, in a good community relations position with the Nuggets, you know, and turned his life around. And it was unfortunate that era, you know, we saw a lot of it here in Chicago with the Bulls. Literally, when Michael came, and in fact, he mentioned that in The Last Dance. And I'd written about that actually in the Jordan rules that, you know, literally half the Bulls roster when Jordan joined him went into drug rehab. Landa Woolridge and Sidney Enos Watley. And so Michael literally would walk down the hall and there would be, you know, marijuana smoke emanating, which is okay now, but not so much then. But yeah, David is one of those that, there's a few players in history that you say, like Derrick Rose, you know, when he had his knee injury with the Bulls in 2012, that's something, you know, he was able to, you know, complete and have a career. But that's a player you say, I wish I would have seen him healthy the rest of his career, because there had never been a point guard, Russell Westbrook included, who played like that with the explosion and athleticism at the rim. And that's with David. David is a player that I think many times when his name is mentioned, I wish I could have seen him win a whole career, because he certainly would have been a top 75. But more than that, he would have been one of these incredible attractions. And there's not many, you know, the rare player who you say, yeah, I'll pay to see him play, you know, like a LeBron, like a Steph Curry now. You know, there's only a couple of them that you say, yeah, Jokic. Yeah, I'd like to see that play. That's worth the money. And David Thompson would have been worth that money. He was the guy who said, yeah, I want to see that.
Having done this, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show, sports fans, basketball fans, we all love to argue about who's the best. Typically starts with players, and then it goes from there. Having done this with Phil, would you like to do coaches or games or best NBA finals, whatever? Do you want to go down this road again, you think?
Actually, you know, we had so much, I had to cut it back. I probably have two more books of me and Phil talking, but I think we used that up. But actually, that's why I like this one, and I did it this way. There's a lot of books, and, you know, many good ones, and, you know, I think people enjoy many of them, of these lists, and who's the best, and, you know, oh, the barroom argument thing. This is different. I wanted it to be different, and I think, to me, that's the appeal, and that's what I like about it, that, you know, it's not that. It's not a recitation of, you know, the numbers and the statistics, and there's so much, you know, analytical these days, and you could measure things. You know, I'm not, you know, younger people, you know, older people are not analytically oriented that much. But I always joke about the story about the guy who drowned in the water that averaged 3 feet. Well, you know, it depends on where you step. So you can fix numbers to any way. This is two people who have witnessed, you know, the entire basic history of the modern history of the NBA, and know the people who participated in it. And just in short little chunks and anecdotes talked about that. So I think that to me is the interest more than the numbers. The numbers have a place. I'm not as interested in that as kind of, I think this is more fun.
We need to make that a fast break. Much more with Sam Smith coming up next right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation with Sam Smith. He covered the NBA for many years for the Chicago Tribune. He also wrote the definitive book on the Chicago Bulls of the 1990s called The Jordan Rules. His new book, written with retired coach Phil Jackson, is called Masters of the Game. I do want to ask you, Sam, since you have seen every era of the NBA, you well remember that North Carolina for a long time did not have an NBA team until the late 80s when the Hornets came on the scene. And it is not a franchise draped in glory when it comes to championships. They've never even been to the conference finals, although they were, particularly in the early days, one of the strongest supported teams in the NBA. So what do you make of NBA basketball in Charlotte over these roughly 35, 36 years?
I remember when they were an expansion team. I remember riding down the Billy Graham Parkway to get to the arena. I remember, you know, that arena. You're right. They led the attendance, I think, for the first 7 straight years. And so, you know, it was a great environment. And it really was a great team. Kendall Gill, who was one of their players, is a friend. You know, he does the Bulls pregame and postgame. So I see Kendall a lot, you know, at the games. Actually, his son just signed at Northwestern. It looks like he's going to be a good Division I player. But with Larry Johnson and Alonzo Mourning, they really had a team that could have been, you know, a championship contender. Larry got hurt. You know, Larry Johnson would have been another of those. Maybe not, certainly not David Thompson's level. But had he not got the back surgery, the back injuries, he would have been an elite all-time, could have been an elite all-time player. And obviously Lonzo, you know, going to Miami and making a Hall of Fame as well. And Kendall was, you know, so much more athletic than both of them. You know, an amazing athlete. They really had, a good core to start. They just had, as, you know, I'm sure the fans know, their, you know, really dysfunctional ownership and just destroyed the franchise. And, you know, it's hard to recover from that. And then, you know, the NBA, it's interesting, you know, when Michael retired in 98 and from the Bulls the first time before he went back with Washington, although, you know, we try to forget that, you know, he was popular. He's always the most popular. And then ownership, you know, the notion was they broke up the team. They really didn't break up the team. Michael was done. He made it clear. And I know even he kept that going in the Last Dance. But I know from having heard him, he was so worn out, like he was in 93 with the team and what he went through. And you can imagine with everything, you say, with the first three championships, but the last three where they have this incredible group, nothing that will ever be repeated, nothing that ever happened before in sports. You've got the greatest player, the greatest coach, and the craziest guy all together on the same team that wins all the time. It's unheard of. And so he's just completely worn out. He's done. And the team is coming apart. Rodman completely is going off the rails. You know, Pippen wants to be traded every day, had back surgery. Players are, you know, free agents and trying to cash in, you know, because you're always overpaid. When everybody watches the finals and sees a guy do something, they think they could do that for that team next season. No, they can't. They're doing it because they're playing with Michael Jordan or, you know, some great player. That's why they're so good. You know, so then teams find out Luke Longley and Steve Kerr and Judd Bushler really can't play, you know, but with Michael Jordan, they can play. So, you know, he's done, and I talk too much sometimes, so I digress. So I forgot what point I was trying to make.
Well, I think you were going with Michael Jordan as owner of the Bobcats and Hornets.
Right. So what the community says, well, we want Jordan to run the team. You know, he knows basketball. Look, he wins so much. We don't want these other guys running the team, Jerry Krause or the owner, Jerry Reinsdorf. And the community is in like up in arms, put Michael GM. And the team is trying to say, well, no, you know, he's a player. That's what he knows. He, just because you can play, there are specialties. You know, just because you're great at one thing, it doesn't mean you're great at other. Michael's great at playing because of who he is. So, anyway, so time comes, the NBA's trying, and David Stern was great at doing this, and he's trying to dig out from bad situations. He did it in a couple of places, Minnesota. You know, he would bring in, he would tell.
This is the former NBA commissioner, David Stern.
Right, David Stern, who to hire as, you know, GMs or whatever, get an owner. And so they want Michael in the league, you know, his presence, and he wants to be involved. So they basically cut him a deal, like, you know, a great deal to take over the Charlotte franchise. But, you know, he's not, you know, when Michael runs something, he wants to do it. He wants hands-on. He's a hands-on guy. He's not a delegator, basically. So in other words, like, you know, last shot, I'm taking the last shot. I ain't passing the ball the last shot. And, you know, he wasn't a good judge of talent because that's not what he was trained to do. He was a judge of how Michael Jordan saw talent. And so, you know, it was a lamentable period. It's some bad luck. You know, Adam Morrison got hurt. You know, there were some times in the lottery, bad years where they didn't get lucky. And, you know, a lot of greatness in the NBA is being lucky, you know. When the Bulls got Jordan number three, because, you know, Portland picked Sam Bowie, you know, and Rod Thorne becomes GM of the year. It wasn't because he made some, you know, brilliant decision. It's because Jordan fell in his lap and he picked him. You know, he just didn't do the stupid thing of passing him. So
you're saying the Hornets need some good luck. They're due. They're due.
Yeah. And they've had really bad luck in the draft in recent years. And then, you know, frankly, LaMelo Ball is a disaster. You know, he's a selfish player, and you got to get rid of him. You just got to get him off the court. I would, you know, I know it's hard to get rid of big salaried players, but some people can't, you know, can't play with others. and he's a talent, but he can't play with others because he's not team oriented. And so he's kind of out there for himself. So they're stuck in a bit of a mess now. I think that they finally can get themselves out of it. I like the coach. I think the organization knows what it wants to do now, has a path. And I think they just got to get themselves out from under some of these bad contracts, namely Ball. You know, who they basically are, get it. You know, he was a high draft pick and he's talented and it looked like he could be, you know, and he is a talent. He just can't be your best player. He just can't be the guy who has the ball all the time because he wants to put on a show with it rather than helping the other guys improve. But they do have some other, you know, Knipple, however you pronounce that, was a good
pick.
Yes,
Con Knipple, the rookie, yes.
Yeah, the kid from who was out last season, the other guy is
Brandon Miller.
Is a very good player. And so they're finally getting some pieces. They should be high in the lottery this year if they just get, you know, like Dallas. Dallas jumped up to get number one. That's all you got to do. You know, not that they've saved themselves from this disastrous, you know, Doncic trade, which was disaster, but, you know, Cooper Flagg is going to save them in the future. And that's all you got to do. You just got to hit once. And Charlotte's problem is they didn't hit once. And you only got to hit once.
Got to hit once. My guest is Sam Smith. He is the co-author of the new book, Masters of the Game. He's hit more than once covering the NBA and the glory years of Michael Jordan. Of course, we cannot talk about NBA basketball in the state of North Carolina without mentioning a guy who played high school ball here in Charlotte and then shocked everyone by taking little old Davidson College on a magical run to the Elite Eight in the 2008 NCAA tournament. I'm talking about Steph Curry. And he's done okay as a pro, too.
They do have a timeout. Decide not to use it. Curry, way downtown. Bang! Bang! Oh, what a shot from Curry! With 0.6 seconds remaining.
That's Mike Breen calling Curry's 38-footer in 2016 in overtime to beat Oklahoma City. What do you think of when you think of Steph Curry?
Obviously, it's remarkable. You know, the scorer shooter he's become. Now, you know, I get defensive sometimes, not to take anything away from Curry, but, you know, a lot of players who are great shooters, Pete Maravich or Rick Barry, especially in that era, you know, they realized, well, you know, you don't get an extra point for shooting from 30 feet. So, you know, we're going to shoot from 15 feet because, you know,
there was no three-point line at the time.
It kind of makes sense to shoot it from closer. So, you know, it's hard to compare. One of the interesting parts is we've always heard, and I'm sure you've heard it there too, that he eventually wants to finish in Charlotte, you know, back home in North Carolina. His dad, you know, is still, and his dad, by the way, was as good a shooter as he was. He just couldn't dribble the ball. But I remember doing shooting lists in when I was covering the team in the late 80s and the early 90s, and I would go around and poll the other players. And it was much easier to deal with players then. You know, they weren't so, not the wealthy, but, you know, they didn't hire their own friends and, you know, there wasn't much access. And I always used to go around and ask, oh, who's the best this, who's the best that? And when I would do polls of other players, just informally talking to them, it was Curry. They would say, you know, that's the best shooter in the league. You know, but he's coming off the bench because he can't, you know, handle the ball well. He doesn't defend that well. But if I wanted to make a shot, I heard players in that era say, if I had one shot to make, I'd give the ball to Del Curry. And so.
I'm curious, you know, this would lend itself to one of your conversations with Phil. You look at the best players, but one of the things that strikes me about the Currys, because remember, Steph's brother, Seth, has been in the league right for over a decade. You obviously mentioned Dell and Steph. The way the Mannings are viewed as kind of the first family of football, could you make an argument that the Currys are maybe the most successful basketball family?
Well, Steph is.
But I mean, to have a father and two sons in the league, Sam, you've got an encyclopedic knowledge and memory of NBA basketball. Who else would be comparable?
Well, you know, it is unique. Now, of course, the Mannings both won Super Bowls as quarterbacks. And, you know, there's nowhere you could go watch TV and not see Peyton Manning selling something. So his presence is, you know, omnipresent. Now, the thing about Steph, and, you know, not to take away from, you know, any of the family, and it's impressive, you know, to have, you know, that lineage in professional sports, although, you know, his brother is, you know, kind of a role player. And like we said about Dell, you know, I think, you know, most fans wouldn't know Dell was so good. They would know him as, his, you know, Steph's dad. I don't think very many basketball fans now have any idea how good Dell was as a player. But, you know, what is particularly impressive about Steph Curry is the humanity of him. Yeah, I know the shooting and the spectacular shots and all, but, you know, just what a decent, and not that NBA players generally are good, really good people, very, you know, very accommodating, good to deal with, the best in all sports to me. You know, football is, you know, the military, you know, it's all secrets and everybody, you know, and baseball, you know, no offense, but kids are playing, you know, in Durham Bulls and something and all, you know, they're not ready to be dumped into New York City or LA or, you know, these kids in basketball, you know, they're basically pros when they're 12 years old, you know, they've been dealing with everybody. And so, you know, you get a certain sophistication that doesn't exist in other sports. And Steph, you know, transcends that all with a, you know, everyman kind of attitude and, you know, a respect for other people and also, you know, that love of the game thing that Jordan had. I think he talked about it in this last thing, this love of the game clause that he had in his first contract, which, by the way, was taken out very quickly. He didn't have it very long, even though one of my favorite stories in the second year when he got hurt, broke his foot in the third game of the season, the team sent him home to North Carolina to rehab. And instead of that, he played pickup ball every day, unbeknownst to the team, which he wasn't supposed to be doing. And they said if he did, you know, he'd never play again. His career would be over. He'd break his ankle. And so Michael, yeah, right, I'm going to stop playing basketball. But, you know, so Steph strikes me in that way is that he's got, you know, in this era where it's hard to find because they're so separated from the press and the public, that Steph has that connection that does his own. So that always stands out with me, not to diminish his family accomplishments, which have been impressive, but he really, you know, towers over this. And well, we'll see how far Bronny gets and the next kid after that, and then we'll make our judgment. But I got a feeling it's going to be LeBron and everybody else.
That's a fair point. I'm curious, Phil, as you mentioned, is not very connected to the NBA. He doesn't really love the modern game. You still cover it, although I get the sense in the book that you don't always love where the game has gone. Right. So given that, if Adam Silver hands you the baton and says, you're the commissioner, give me two or three things you would change about the current game to make it better.
Well, one of the things, you know, Phil, we've talked about this too. Phil brings up, and it's a valid point, and it's been talked about, you know, at times, but the court is too small, you know, for the way they want to play. You know, they're so, and that is a difference. They are so much physically longer, long arms, bigger. The heights are not, you know, I mean, obviously Wembanyama, there's some tall players. But, you know, if you want to really open the court, you ought to widen it a little bit, maybe lengthen it another few feet, but certainly widen it a little bit, you know, but they're not going to take out those seats because they're so revenue generating, you know, so that's one point. They want to change the number of games. I wouldn't do that. I don't believe that needs to be done. I mean, and I understand the world changes and moves on, and you know, we have to turn it over to the next group, and that's fine, and that's the way it's supposed to be. But you know, there's so much of this analytical judgments that's taken over the game that it's enabled to make judgments about players' health, for instance, or you know, you can justify when guys play, how often they have to sit. There's no science to sitting out games and then being able to play. The biggest thing to me they've taken out of the game, which changed it, is they don't practice anymore. And if you go around to the Hornets, you'll find out too, they never practice. Training camp is, you know, maybe every other day, one scrimmage. And then during the season, because they're worried about injuries or they pay them so much, I got to be careful. You got to play ball to be in shape to play ball. You can't just, you know, work out, shoot, lift weights with a coach, and then get on the court and run 100 miles an hour because they're playing faster now. There's more possessions. And so the biggest thing to me is I would make him play basketball more. They don't play. They get private workout coaches. Frankly, you know, as crazy as that sounds, They just never practice playing, and then your body can't stand up to playing when it's time to play.
And then they're hurt. I think that's a perfect last word from Sam Smith, who is the co-author of Masters of the Game with Phil Jackson. Sam, thank you for the time today.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the discussion. Thanks.
So I spent the past hour trying to be like Mike Collins, not Jordan. I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.